Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 385, titled Formula for Disaster, being recorded on October 27th of the year 2002. Now, as I emphasized in the first side of this program, and as I will repeat, though not at as great a length, this broadcast is speculative in nature, and I want to make that emphatic. The book that I will be reading from, titled The Formula by Steve Shagan, was a novel published in the late 1970s and made into a major motion picture of the same name, starring, among others, George C. Scott and Marlon Brando. I believe that, as is mentioned in the promotional text on the back of the softcover edition of this book, I believe that this is a book that is based very strongly in fact. The back promotional text says, "The Formula, a blockbuster novel founded in fact, it tells the chilling tale of Germany's most explosive wartime secret, synthetic fuel." And I would note that Germany's wartime secret was not necessarily a secret. It was really quite well known. In fact, as I mentioned inside one of this program, and as has been discussed since 1980, ironically enough, in the work that I've been producing in a miscellaneous archive show M11, recorded on May 23rd of 1980, I discussed the standard IG agreement of 1929, arguably the most important cartel agreement of the 20th century, by the two arguably most important industrial concerns of that or this century, Standard Oil of New Jersey or IG Farben, now broken into a number of member companies but surviving. That cartel deal basically gave IG Farben badly needed capital. It was a debt equity swap. They became the largest stockholder in Standard Oil behind the Rockefeller family. That gave them badly needed capital that they had that capital had been bled out from IG Farben due to the development of the hydrogenation process to make oil from coal. That process, in turn, was licensed to IG Farben to manufacture synthetic gasoline or synthetic oil in Germany only. Standard Oil, in turn, was licensed to use the hydrogenation process to manufacture synthetic fuel all over the world, thereby assuring its profit base. The hydrogenation process was used by Germany and by the IG Farben company to synthesize oil from coal during World War II. Because the process was not nearly as efficient as it probably has been made since, but because the process was relatively inefficient, the oil that was produced from coal was not economically competitive with naturally produced oil drilled out of the ground. What this, quote, novel, unquote, is about, and it is, of course, a novel, is about a formula. That is the title for a catalyst produced, according to this novel, hypothetically produced, I believe, in fact, probably produced. That formula enabled the hydrogenation process to be made dramatically more efficient, and that, in turn, made the synthetic oil dramatically more economical and competitive with natural oil drilled out of the ground. What this novel is about the politics surrounding this formula and the effect that it has had on the world petroleum industry. With all of the advances made in organic chemistry and in technology since 1929, I think it is highly improbable that, in fact, the hydrogenation process has remained fallow. And note, as I mentioned in the first half of the program, the control of this, quote, formula, unquote, would have given the holder of it control over the entire world, because countries that produced oil could have been held via blackmail. One could have grabbed them by the throat, so to speak, and used the formula as a tremendous element of leverage. And in turn, the oil companies themselves and the industrial nations of the world could have been affected to similar leverage, because the utilization of this formula could have freed any industrial nation from its bondage, so to speak, its economic bondage, to the oil-producing nations of the world. And that would have included, by the way, both on the industrial and oil-producing side, the former Soviet Union. So this basically was all around the world, so to speak. Now, I'm going to go back into the discussion, and please note that I'm discussing this. Occasionally one has to venture out beyond the wire, so to speak, and I am bringing this up at this time because with all of the cataclysmic things that threaten and all of the horrendous things that are going on, I believe that this allegedly fictional formula is in fact a reality, and that just such a formula was in all probability utilized by the Underground Reich, or the Third Reich as it was going underground, and the Bormann Organization, which in turn is inextricably linked with the old IG Farben complex and with the Standard Oil firms. I believe that this formula has been utilized as a pivot point of post-World War II politics. It would have controlled not only the oil companies, but the industrialized world, the United States, the former Soviet Union, and, by the way, the Middle East as well, not incidentally. We're going to return to this novel, and we're going to take a look at something which, again, I believe was in all probability based in fact. The Dr. Esau here is a fictional character. He was in charge in the book of the IG Farben synthetic fuel program, and he was the developer of the mangan formula, as it is hypothetically named in the book, that in turn produced by the Genesis Project. Again, a hypothetical name for something which in all probability was actually developed, as I've noted in For the Record Program 278, among others, and the other programs discussing the CDU funding scandal. That funding scandal involved maneuvering between, and note the participants here, the Thiessen firm, the Thiessen heavy industrial firm linked in a profound way to the Bush family, as we've seen in For the Record Program 273 and in For the Record Program 370, among others, the French ELF oil company, which is also linked to the Underground Reich and to the complex German corporate web weaving through Europe, including the Bertelsmann firm. And also, in terms of the heavy industrial product, Thiessen was marketing tanks to Saudi Arabia as part of this very complex deal. Note that Germany's largest synthetic fuel plant was located at Leuna, and that it was the so-called Battle of Leuna, the bombing of the Leuna plant by the 8th Army Air Force in World War II, that brought the Third Reich to its knees by basically destroying its fuel-producing, fuel-synthesizing capability. Even though the Germans were able to keep Leuna operating, they had to cannibalize materiel and personnel from other synthetic fuel plants in order to keep it operating. The Soviets rebuilt that plant after World War II, and its continued existence would have represented a very, very significant jewel of industry, so to speak, in the post-war period. And I don't think it is in any way coincidental that the Thiessen firm, the French ELF firm, and Saudi Arabia were involved in the manipulation, along with the French Conservative Party and the CDU, in the maneuvering around the Leuna plant. Now, returning to the formula by Steve Shagan, we're going to look at a hypothetical. I believe this was in all probability something that actually occurred. We know that that just such maneuvering was taking place, and with the exception of Dr. Esau and a fictional General Clodden here, the characters here are real. One of the real characters here is SS General Walter Schellenberg, in charge of foreign intelligence for the SS and a key operative on behalf of the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit after World War II. Schellenberg, in turn, was involved with negotiations with Alan Dulles, obviously a real character, the fellow who masked the Bush family investments in Nazi Germany in partnership with the Thiessen firm. And Alan Dulles, of course, key CIA director and a partner in Sullivan and Cromwell, and an individual whose personages figures and whose person figures in a very, very powerful way with the various post-war machinations that we've looked at in connection with September 11th, among other things. Alan Dulles had more connections than a switchboard, as I like to say. Those connections to people like SS General Karl Wolff, people like François Genoux, and a number of others, or the milieu of François Genoux, and many others as well. Turning to the formula, and a conversation here between the fictional Dr. Esau and the very real Walter Schellenberg, and referring to the very real negotiations taking place with SS General Wolf and Alan Dulles. SS Brigadier General Walter Schellenberg, Chief of Foreign Intelligence for Reichsfuhrer Himmler, entered the room, skipping ahead. The Reich is defeated. We must therefore save as much of the German nation as possible, unquote. I am prepared to carry out the mission, Clauden replied. Again, he's a fictional SS general. Schellenberg paced for a moment, then placed himself in the center of the suite. SS General Wolf is at the moment in Zurich conducting secret negotiations with the Chief of American Intelligence, Alan Dulles. Wolf has made the proposition to turn over to the Americans our most critical military documents concerning research and development of secret weapons. We offer this information in return for amnesty for those of us who have served the Reich in certain areas that may be construed as war crimes. I would add hypothetically, of course, this, not hypothetically, but I would add parenthetically, excuse me, that this, of course, refers to Project Paperclip, about which we've spoken many times in the past. Returning to the formula, Schellenberg speaking here. In addition, we are seeking American guarantees that they will enter Berlin before the city falls to the Soviets. Schellenberg sipped some more champagne and turned to Dr. Esau. Please describe to the general the materials we will be surrendering, unquote. Dr. Esau spoke in a cold, clipped monotone. The principal documents pertain to the ME-262 jet fighter, the new 88mm anti-aircraft battery with electronic Zeiss sights, the V-1 and V-2 rockets, the design engineering of the jet wind tunnel, the remote-control ground-to-air heat-seeking missile, the long-range rockets known as A-4 and A-9, the design for the uranium-powered submarine, and finally, all our files on synthetics, unquote. Schellenberg said, thank you, doctor, and turned to Clauden. And again, this, I believe, is obviously taken from fact. Just such negotiations were going on between Wolf and Dulles. Just such negotiations were going on involving Schellenberg. And we know that the top German weapons were key focal points of American interest and that amnesty was, in fact, achieved. Obviously, Dr. Esau is a fictional character, but with the profound cartel agreements between IG Farben and the petroleum industry, given the probability that, though the certainty that just such a catalyst would have been a key focal point of German R&D in World War II, I don't think that this is much of a stretch. But again, let me stress, this is a novel, and this broadcast is speculative in nature. I would note that the credits on the novel by Steve Shagan. The author wishes to express his gratitude to the staff of the United States Mission, Berlin Documentation Center. And skipping ahead, when Barney Kane, by the way, an LAPD detective and an ex-CIA agent who was manipulated into tracking down the surviving German scientists from the Genesis Project and eliminating them so that they would not be in a position to wrestle control of the mangan formula for making the hydrogenation process more efficient, thereby threatening its control by the petroleum industry. The conversation here is between a character known as Adam Stiefel, the head of Tidal Oil, part of the oil cartel, and Barney Kane, the LAPD detective and ex-CIA agent. They were played in the movie, respectively, by Marlon Brando and by the late George C. Scott. By the way, this hypothetical conversation takes place in a copper-lined room that Stiefel keeps in his headquarters. This prevents the monitoring of this conversation by remote electronic devices. Over the entrance to the door to this copper room in the novel, it says, "When money talks, people listen." Bear that in mind. Stiefel stroked his hair, placed the cigar in an ashtray, and looked at Barney, considering the merits of his request. Both their faces took on magenta tones from the overhead light bouncing off the copper walls. "All right," Stiefel said. "I think you're entitled to some answers." He rose, paced for a moment, and reflectively said, "Over the years, we have been concerned with the continued existence of the surviving German scientists who worked on the Genesis program. But our concern was benign. After all, We control the oil from the sands to the pumps. And the manufacture of synthetic fuel was an economic impossibility. Therefore, we were content to let sleeping dogs lie. But when the Swiss industrialist contacted Obermann, everything changed, unquote. Barney interrupted. How did you know about the Swiss contact? Obermann dutifully reported that contact to Diestel, and we became actively concerned. By the way, parenthetically, as we looked at on the first side, Diestel was XSS and controlled the Kameradschaft, or one of the post-war SS fraternal organizations, and this was utilized by him to help murder some of the surviving Genesis scientists. By the way, at the end of the novel, Diestel himself is done in. Continuing. Obermann dutifully reported that contact to Diestel, and we became actively concerned. Why, Barney asked, what's wrong with making America self-sufficient in synthetic fuel? The old man stared at Barney with a look of total wonder. Do you honestly expect a $300 billion industry to undermine its own stake in the lucrative scarcity of oil by mass-producing synthetic fuel? Stifel walked back to his desk and sat down. We've had that formula in our possession since the conclusion of the war. British intelligence turned it over to our chemists in early 46. We even imported a few German scientists to build pilot hydrogenation plants to be certain the process was economically unsound. We terminated those plants in 56, but, he paused, that was 22 years ago. Things change. The price of crude oil has risen dramatically since 73, making the production of synthetic fuel an economic possibility. The Genesis formula makes it an economic reality. Therefore, we could not risk the formula falling into the wrong hands. And note again that what they're utilizing here is coal, and I would note the Bush administration's tremendous emphasis on coal. The Bush administration, of course, is headed up by George W. Bush, oil man, the great-grandson of one of the charter partners with the Thyssen firm in helping to fund Adolf Hitler, and an individual who is bound by the ties that bind, as I like to say, to this transatlantic Third Reich-connected industrial axis that lies at the foundations of much of the inquiry in connection with September 11th and an awful lot of other things in the 20th century, and now the 21st. Note again that Bush is the president and an oil man. Dick Cheney is the vice president. And in numerous broadcasts, I've taken a look at the energy industry links to this administration. Reprising a short section that we looked at on the first side, Stifel walked up to the big glass window and Barney sat down in a chair facing the circular desk. Don't feel too disheartened, son, Stifel said, turning back to Barney. We will manufacture synthetic fuel and in great quantity. We already own most of the coal in the country. We know what's coming. We have the formula. We have the mangan catalyst and we have the technology, but we must be certain of profit. By 1990, the country will be on its knees to OPEC. The government will then turn to us, and in their desperation, they will ensure our profit position in the manufacture of synthetic fuel. And I would note in this regard, again, that among the Bush family businesses, and among the Bush family businesses that were masked by Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell into the Harriman 15 holding company was the Silesian American Corporation, which was one of the companies that was situated, or a subsidiary of which was situated at Auschwitz in order to take advantage of the slave labor camps at Auschwitz and the coal deposits of Silesia in order to make synthetic fuel for IG Farben and the Reich. And the Silesian American Corporation, one of the Bush family businesses with the Third Reich, subsumed by Alan Dulles into the Harriman 15, along with the Union Banking Corporation, from which both George Bush's largesse stems in a large measure. In considerable measure. Now, turning once again to the formula, and consider the concept of blackmail here. Consider the tremendous power of this, I believe, actually existing formula, but what is presented here as fiction. And again, this is speculative. Conversation here between Lisa Spangler and Barney Kane. "It's ironic to think so many died for 8 pages of scientific questions," she said thoughtfully. Barney didn't respond, but he thought about the truth of her words. He thought about those who had perished, the slaves, the inmate workers at IG Farben Auschwitz, and all the others at the 15 hydrogenation plants, those huge factories and refineries that had mysteriously escaped Allied bombing. I would add that is, of course, up until the Battle of Loyna, when the Loyna plant got plastered by the 8th Army Air Force. It was rebuilt by the Soviets, and again, it was the focal point of maneuvering between the French oil company, ELF, and the Thyssen firm, linked to this whole Bush-related, Dulles-related complex that we've been speaking about, and the Saudis and the Soviets. That discussed in, for the record, 278, among other programs. So consider the Bush-Silesian American link to the IG Farben plant and the slave labor at Auschwitz that we took a look at in, for the record, 370. Consider also the possibility that this particular formula may have been leaked to others. In this case, and this is entirely hypothetical, but I wouldn't discount the possibility that this might have happened. But suppose, for example, that Israel had somehow gotten a hold of this formula. That's what happens in the novel, but this is obviously hypothetical. What happens in the novel is that Barney Kane mails a copy of the formula to Israel. Stifel's eyes widened, his lips quivered, and his voice trembled. He breathed the word as if he'd heard it for the first time. Israel? Why Israel? Barney said, "The formula went to Israel because they have no connections with big oil. It was circumstance. Pure chance. It was Heisenberg, those random particles. They'll kill you every time." The old man turned and moved to his desk. "You're out of my hands. You have created a situation that has removed you from my care. You're a damn fool, Mr. Kane, a suicidal maniac. You disappoint me. I gave you credit for more intelligence." "You made a mistake," Barney said. "You may be in a little bit of trouble, Mr. Stifel." He turned and started for the door. "Kane," the old man shouted. Barney looked back at the old man. The color had gone out of his cheeks and his lips were blue. His voice was tense but composed. "Sending the formula to Israel is specious and futile. They have no coal, no minerals, no funds. All they have are oranges," unquote. "But they have science," Barney said, "and they have connections. And you know how it is," Barney paused. "When money talks, people listen." And again, I don't know if that actually happened, but it's interesting to contemplate. It's also interesting that if such a thing happened, bear in mind the not only the use of the formula as a tool for blackmail, but bear in mind what I discussed in, for the record, 384. Suppose you're the Underground Reich. Suppose you want to wipe the Jews off the face of the earth, destroy America, and wipe out the Arabs. You don't have enough troops to do it yourself. Get them to do it to each other. And suppose the oil companies are getting doubled on by the Underground Reich, and they're very good at doubling on people as well as blackmailing people. They may be simply figuring, well, what the heck, we're going to drive up the price of oil, and that will make the use of synthetic fuel, including wood and coal, more economically competitive. But at the same time, I would note that suppose Israel did have this. You wipe out Israel, you wipe out the Arabs, you get them to wipe out each other, you get the Americans to do much of the same thing, and then you have, out of vengeance, Arab terrorists destroying or simply threatening to destroy and subjugate the United States. And again, this will all perhaps sound somewhat crazy to some listeners, but let's go back to this novel, and let's go back to the conversation here by Dr. Esau, the opening conversation, and Barney Kane. Barney found it hard to believe that this relic, this skeleton of a man, had once wielded incredible power, that this cancer-ridden ghost had possessed the genius that provided the energy requirements for the Reich. His slack mouth gathered itself and his lips moved slowly. "The French are building an atomic reactor in northern Iraq," unquote. Barney was speechless. It was one of those non sequiturs that defied answer. "Did you know that?" Esau rasped. Barney shook his head. "No, I didn't. The French will do anything for a profit. During the occupation, their scientists worked hand in glove with me. The resistance was a myth. All through the war, the Parisian nightclubs were open, the racetracks ran, the restaurants were full. The French are a people whose principal character trait is accommodation," unquote. "And now they sell the Iraqis an atomic reactor," unquote. He coughed twice and wiped some spittle from his lips. "The world will end within 2 centuries. Of that, there can be no question." And again, in numerous broadcasts, including, for the record, 305, and in some of the broadcasts about the Vivendi firm and German corporate control over France in the post-war period. We touch back on this, by the way, and for the record, 372, the reality of what Esau is talking about here in terms of the French situation, the French involved with the maneuvering about around Leuna, along with the Thyssen firm, is accurate. And note here that the French were indeed building a reactor in Iraq, and that was what the Israelis bombed in 1981. And again, consider what ultimately is proposed here in this fictional account. Barney Kane demands, "What happens when there's no more profit left to squeeze from the citizens? When the whole goddamn world is on its knees?" Barney asked angrily. The old man looked up at the ceiling for a moment and then stared at Barney. "In that case," he said, "the cartel performs its historic duty. We unleash the dogs of war. There are those times when war is both economically and ecologically necessary for the ultimate survival of the species." Unquote. "Business," Stifel replied. "Just business." Kind of like the end of All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin. And there's a quote in one of, I don't know what you'd call them, the end papers, except this is at the beginning of the novel, perhaps under the circumstances, the beginning of the end papers, a quote from Thomas Jefferson. "Money, not morality, is the principal commerce of civilized nations." And again, noting what's going on in the world today, noting the Bush family's connections to the Thyssens, noting the French oil company links to so much of this, noting the Silesian American situation, noting so much of what's going on, and again, noting the indisputable historical foundation of this novel, I think that it is time to consider this at greater length and in greater detail. If this sounds crazy to people, the notion that just such a formula would not have been developed in all of the time and with all of the advances in science is perhaps the craziest of all. Article-length description in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. That, in turn, linked to www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, the streaming WFMU website, and a longer website for download only linked to the Spitfire and WFMU websites. That concludes For the Record 385, Formula for Disaster, being recorded on October 27th of 2002. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.